WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, January 31st, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Arizona to revisit the struggle for ethnic studies in the mid-2000s and what it could teach us about the anti-DEI movement that we see today nationwide. And with us on the show today to discuss this is a fantastic guest. We have with us Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's also the author of a new book entitled Ban, The Fight for Mexican-American Studies in the Streets and in the Courts, which was co-written by Robert Chang from the University of California, Irvine. It's a pleasure to have you once again. Welcome back to the show, Nolan Cabrera.
I really appreciate the invitation, Oscar.
Absolutely. So before we started our correspondence, considering everything that is happening right now, I am tempted to draw parallels right away to the banning of ethnic studies in Arizona, recent events with a new president.
Yeah.
But before we touch on any of that first, I want to begin by going further back to the late 60s.
Okay.
When the development of Mexican-American studies began in the Southwest.
Yes.
I wonder if you could tell us both, you know, the thesis of your book and how the history and development of Mexican-American studies is not exclusive to events that have been covered in the last 20, 25 years in Arizona alone.
Of course, of course. So the history of Mexican-American studies is a very interesting one, and it's very much is parallel with the development of ethnic studies as a whole. And in broad strokes, and please keep in mind, I'm going to be covering, you know, like decades of struggle in a couple of broad strokes. So there's a lot of nuances in here. But the bottom line is that in public schools across the country, that there were just inequitable educational opportunities offered along the lines of race. You know, in Tucson, for example, that it was pretty much given that if you were a brown kid, you were probably going to be in more of like the career technical training areas and not really in the honors classes, different things like that. And these kids were constantly looked down upon. You know, I mean, and not even that long ago, my own father would talk about how when speaking Spanish, when he grew up in Orange County, when they actually had like oranges, if you spoke Spanish, you would get hit with a ruler, you know, and the
really?
Yeah, exactly. And actually my tia, his older sister, was in one of the last formally segregated schools in Southern California between brown and white kids. And so the problem that we have is that folks forever would say, hey, you know, could we please get more opportunities? Could we please get more opportunities? But as the great orator Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and never will. And so the pleas and pleas and pleas just kept falling on deaf ears. And so folks rose up across the country. There was the famous strikes up in San Francisco State and Berkeley, the blowouts in East LA. We had walkouts down here in Tucson as well. And it was a demand for actual meaningful education. And from that sprung this desire for what's now known as ethnic studies, as kind of an umbrella for Black studies, American Indian studies, Asian American studies, and Mexican American studies. But again, I mean, it took students doing this really interesting analysis saying like, look, if you're not going to meet our needs as students, you're not going to have a school. Without students, there is no school. So that's the power of the walkout. They say, we will not participate unless you actually meet us in a meaningful way. And so what ended up happening, though, is folks had to start reconsidering what education meant, because we all agree that kids need to be able to write and read and critically analyze things. But why is a phrase like, I don't know, Tippecanoe and Tyler II relevant to a Chicano from South Tucson? It's trivia. It's like, okay, that'll help you if you're on Jeopardy someday. But like, you know, but how? And instead of this, you know, sort of heroes and holidays type notion of history, you know, just valorizing, you know, the strong person, the strong, usually straight white man or landowner who history focuses on, it was really trying to see what are the cultural contributions of our people, but more importantly, asking the question, how can you actually meaningfully use your education for the uplift of the community as a whole? And just with that little reframing, it gives such power to the students because it gives meaning to the work. I'm not just learning. I'm not just, you know, reading this text for the sake of reading a text. I'm increasing my brain power so that I can do better, so that our community can do better, so that my little brothers and sisters who are coming after me can do better. But it requires seeing students as purveyors of knowledge, because for the longest time, it was just teachers. I am the teacher and I will imprint this information is knowledge in you. And that's not the best model for, I mean, it's great for, you know, if you have rote memorization and trying to take a test, but it doesn't develop critical thinking skills. And most importantly, it doesn't really engage students. And so this creates sort of a larger motivation. What was beautiful about the way that Tucson's program was developed was we have a Mexican American studies program here in the Southwest, in the borderlands region, rooted in critical social analysis, trying to figure out solutions to persistent problems and creating just an engaged and energized student population in the process. But again, that's from the 60s all the way up to the early 2000s. So I literally, that's 40 years in broad swath. But the bottom line is that there's an old adage that was thrown around a lot during the development of the program. And it's attributed to Einstein. I haven't seen it properly attributed, but it said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. This was necessarily taking a different approach to education and really trying to restructure it to meet the needs of the most marginalized students. Yes. And offer what Ronald Takaki, the departed historian, refers to as a different mirror.
Yes, a different mirror. You made that analogy the last time we had you on the show. As a matter of fact, just to mention this, we had a fantastic conversation with you last year along with Will Guzman on the attack on HBCUs and the parallels between that and ethnic studies. It's a fantastic conversation, so we encourage everyone to go to latinomediacollective.com to revisit that conversation because it's so insightful, and I feel like we could have gone on for hours in that last conversation, much like we are right now, because ethnic studies, it dawned on me while you were describing sort of the thesis of your book, is that it's something created to be relevant to the everyday lives of ordinary people in a particular community. And I will say that when it comes to the issue of ethnic studies, because this may be an issue all throughout 2025, is that we're going to do a similar show like this in the coming months ahead with regards to New Mexico and how they deal with ethnic studies as well. Now, you have a section in your book called The Brown Scare, and I think this may be relevant to a certain degree with what we just discussed with regards to the development of Mexican-American studies going back all the way to the late 60s. Because, again, this controversy, for lack of a better term, did not happen in a vacuum only in the last 20, 25 years. But because reactionary lawmakers don't do their homework on these sort of things and on the development of this type of criteria, could you tell us about both the absurdity and the serious consequences of the Brown Scare as you describe it in your book, when pushed by lawmakers?
Absolutely. And so obviously the Brown Scare, we're riffing on the notion of the Red Scare of the 1950s. And I would actually, I'd want to kind of slightly modify your idea that the lawmakers are actually not doing their homework. I actually think they do their homework very, very, very intently, because there's a very simple playbook that we saw in Tucson, but you see it happen consistently. And that is, you take something that is different and not very well understood, then start framing it as threatening and say it, that there's this existential threat here. And then you position yourself to be the one who can stop that threat from occurring. When it came to Mexican-American studies, when Tom Horn, who was then the superintendent of public instruction, really launched his campaign against it, remember, he never, ever, ever once did an audit of the classes or set foot in the classes. But he knew that his constituents did not know what was going on in the classes. And most people in the masses have a very simple idea of what constitutes education. And they say, well, you know, we just need to get back to the writing, reading, arithmetic, and all this other, you know, ethnic studies, DEI stuff. It's just, you know, it just makes people feel good about their stuff. But we, you know, that's not real education. Well, you have to look at what it offers on a deep level, which they necessarily don't. They just fundamentally don't do that. And they prey upon the willful ignorance and also the xenophobia of the masses. You know, if there's one thing that's been tried and true throughout our history, it's that when you can make an ignorant and racist population fearful, you can do whatever you want. You can have a Chinese Exclusion Act. You can have an Operation Wetback. You can ban Mexican American studies. Think about how ridiculous it is with banning trans students in athletics. A guy from the NCAA was on ESPN a couple of weeks ago and said there are 510,000 student athletes in the NCAA throughout the country. There are 10 trans student athletes in there. But you start making people fearful. It's like, my God, you know, well, this runner, he's a sorry 100 meter runner for Harvard, but he's just going to become a woman and then he's going to win it all. And it's stupid. It makes us fundamentally stupid because it distorts reality. But then the problem is it has material consequences. It hurts people because when you start seeing people as a threat, as anti-American, as hurting someone, it gives justification en masse to do harm to those people. And the number of folks who, in a local level, who have been threatened, attacked, had their jobs threatened, all these different things. I mean, there was one extreme case where a friend of mine, who remained anonymous, caught someone putting an unmarked envelope in his mailbox and tried to chase the guy down, lost him in the chase, comes back, and there's a picture of his kids on the playground.
Oh my God.
I mean, so this is not your normal, like, and I'm sure you get this too. Like, you know, you'll get the email haters and someone, you know, drags you on Twitter or something like that. This is not that. I'm saying, like, this is materially, you know, I've been at rallies where people with guns will say, if you take one step forward or make any threatening move, I will not hesitate to use deadly force. And I'm like, I'm 5'8", you're 6'2", you're strapped, I'm not. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, you know, and so it has material consequences. Like, while it is good politics by making people afraid and then saying, well, I can only solve this problem, it has very harmful material consequences. I mean, the ultimate harm that happened in Tucson was they killed the Mexican American Studies program, where at the time it was the most fully developed ethnic studies program in the K-12 environment in the country.
Yes.
And it was also the most successful at raising brown student achievement. Those are things that should be celebrated, not attacked.
Yeah, and I think those facts that you mentioned were certainly mentioned during the legal battle, which we'll mention in the second half of the show. I just want to remind the audience as well that in addition to this situation of the banning of ethnic studies during that time, it was around the same time as the SB 1070, show us your papers type of law. So the issue of fear and intimidation towards brown people was pretty much real, and just as much as real as it is today. And so that gives me the opportunity to segue to someone you just mentioned, alluded to, which was both Tom Horn and John Hoopenthal. And as a matter of fact, since we just mentioned SB 1070, we should also mention the late Russell Pierce, who was the author of SB 1070. So these characters, shall we say, are worth mentioning because, again, these three together actually were quite collective in this assault on brown people in the state of Arizona. I don't think of any other way to describe it other than what we've known over the last 20 years.
Absolutely. It was an all-out attack. And I want to say, let's also be really clear. It is not coincidental that the border crisis, in quotations, and Mexican-American studies just so happens to reach a boiling point. At that point, it was in 2010, which was a midterm election year. And it's really not coincidental that all of a sudden we have another border crisis that just so happens during a presidential year. And if you look historically, every 2 to 4 years, there has been this crisis. Whether we go back to the Sensenbrenner bill back in 2006, which was basically SB 1070 on a national level, which happened in 2006. In the early 2000s, it was always brown people and gay marriage. Then once gay marriage fell off, then it became still migration, but they would throw in the culture wars around ethnic studies or DEI and trans people. But it's the same thing. It's a manufactured crisis that happens every two. It's like clockwork. And you can see it coming just about a year before the election. They start beating the drums and saying, where's the threat coming from? And then making it out to be, because there's the whole perception that Republicans are the law and order party and the Democrats are soft on this. And Tom Horn, John Hoopenthal, and Russell Pierce played upon that really, really well. And so Tom Horn found an opportunity when in 2006 when Dolores Huerta was in Tucson.
I was just about to mention that. And that was something that I wanted to talk about with regards to the absurdity of this brown scare, which is this speech that I completely forgot that Dolores Huerta did.
Yes.
Where she said something to the effect of Republicans hate Latinos.
Exactly. I mean,
this was 20 years ago.
It was 18 years ago. And so this was really a crystallizing point around Mexican American studies. So you had about roughly 10 years of the curriculum and department development at that point. So Dolores Huerta comes to town and says that based upon the Sensenbrenner bill, H.R. 4437. And, you know, and just really saying like, look, you know, if you make people afraid of brown people, it increases your likelihood of getting elected. And when Tom Horn, who was state superintendent at that point, heard that, he was furious. And he sent his deputy superintendent, Margaret Garcia Dugan, to go give a rebuttal. And so the funny part was, so like with Ms. Huerta in town, it was an assembly and students could ask questions. If they disagreed with her statement, they could push back. There was all this, there was a back and forth. When Garcia Logan came down to say, I, as a proud Latina, am an example that Republicans do not hate Latinos, attendance was mandatory and there was no Q&A. The students just had to sit there and listen. And it's like, I mean, and then the underlying irony is that Tom Ford accused Mexican-American studies of indoctrination. When in fact, I mean, that's the definition of indoctrination right there. When you cut off the free flow of ideas and silent speech, that it necessarily leads to that indoctrination. And what happened, why that became a tipping point, was that the students were upset and they said, I'm not going to take this, but I can't, you know, what can I do? So they stood up in the middle of the assembly. A lot of them had overshirts. They took the overshirts off and on their shirts, it said, you can silence my voice, but not my spirit. And then symbolically put painter's tape over their mouths. And Tom Horn saw that and said, I have never, ever seen a group of students act so disrespectfully to anyone in my time. And I'm like, then that means you haven't been in a classroom, because that's very minor. Like, and he said, this is again that logical leap. They must have learned this disrespect by taking Mexican American studies classes. And so he started assembling these anonymous reports from quote unquote whistleblowers. We don't know who they are. They're just anonymous people saying, hey, I hate Mexican American studies because it teaches me to hate white people or something. I mean, we have no sources. We have no nothing. That was the foundation that he built all this off of. And so then John Hoopenthal, if we fast forward a couple of years, so Tom Horn actually successfully gets the bill passed in 2010. With the help of Russell Pierce as the head of the Arizona State Senate. Russell Pierce, by the way, as a known white supremacist who was the head of our Senate at the time and became the first and only head of the Senate in any state in the history of the country to be recalled because he was too racist and extreme. I mean, he was too racist and extreme for Arizona in the early 2010s. I mean, that tells you where we were at that point. And so John Hoopenthal was a state senator and then was trying to be the state superintendent of public instruction. And I couldn't believe it when he was running. Well, I could believe it because, again, I was living through it. He ran in radio segment and I had to double check it because I was like, there's no way that I could have heard this correctly. Like I was driving up Stone. I was trying to go to my gym and I hear him say, if elected, I will stop La Raza. And I'm like, wait. Time out.
Yeah.
Because let's process that for a second.
Yes.
Like if he said, if elected, I will stop the Asians. If elected, I will stop Black people. If elected, I will stop the Jews. Like, put any ethnic group in there aside from Latinos, in particular Mexican Americans, you're disqualified. Like, that's it. You're done. That led him to become state superintendent of public instruction and be responsible for. So Tom Horn basically helped create the law. And then John Hoopenthal was the one who got to implement it. And basically what it said, for those who aren't familiar, I mean, now it's been 14 years since, you're not allowed to have classes that promote the overthrow of the U.S. government, treat pupils as representatives of their race as opposed to individuals. What was it? Are made specifically for students of a particular racial ethnic group or promote racial antagonism or hatred towards a specific group. Now, the problem is, how do you interpret any of this? What does it mean to promote racial resentment towards a group? How it was interpreted was, if you're talking about, I don't know, manifest destiny, and you take the perspective of Mexicans and indigenous peoples, and you're getting invaded by white folk, by saying that, you know, white settlers are coming across and taking our land, that is seen as promoting racism. How do you determine if a class is made for a specific racial ethnic group? If it's a 95% white AP European history class in the north side of town, that's not seen as being, it's just happenstance. But if it's an 85% Mexican-American class on Mexican-American studies in a 60 to 70% Latino district, that's seen as being designed. So really, it's only seen as a threat when low-income brown kids are learning about their histories, their cultures. But when, you know, white kids are allowed to do exactly the same thing, it gets a complete pass. And so that's where the struggle came in. But for both Horn and Hoopenthal, it required them to willfully misrepresent what was happening in the classroom and just continually say, this is anti-white, anti-American indoctrination.
Sounds familiar.
Of course. And the funny part is, the one area where Hoopenthal was sensitive to a limitation of Horn was he said, okay, I would like to get some information on this. I want to conduct an audit. His hand-picked audit in an allegedly broke state. So we have we're a broke state, but he found $110,000 to put together this audit. His own hand-picked audit came back and said, after reviewing the curriculum materials and I think interviewing about 30 to 40% of the teachers and doing all this work, there's no observable evidence that state law was violated. And it is highly likely, given the administrative data from the district, that taking these classes actually raises student achievement in important, significant ways. That's his own handpicked audit.
Oh my goodness. Well, that story lends itself to the legal battle that would proceed and the legal victory further down the road. But I'm glad you broke things down that way. And it's also important that you mention other ethnic studies here, because while we're talking about Mexican-American studies, the ambiguity of banning ethnic studies, you know, lends itself to banning all sorts of other studies with regards to other communities. This is precisely why we had you on the show last year with Will Guzman to talk about HBCUs, because if something like this were to be successful, the banning of ethnic studies in the state of Arizona and would spread elsewhere, then it would call into question the very existence of HBCUs. And the reality of it all is it underlines two things that you sort of mentioned. One thing that's clear to both you and I, it's censorship with regards to history. And the other issue that's kind of hard to mention, but equally as important to address, is the defunding of public education along the way, correct?
Exactly. And that's the whole point, is that, you know, we talk about how it has material consequences, and you're right, that's the big thing, is that, and there's a certain irony to it as well, that let's be clear about the history here, that privatization in particular has been a long time coming. I mean, this goes back to the deregulations of the Reagan Revolution. You know, I mean, the whole idea that that theory of trickle-down economics, reduce as many regulations, get as much capital in the hands of the capitalists as possible, and it trickles down to the everyday person, never worked. It's never been, it just sounds nice, you know, or as the Reverend Sharpton liked to say, we as the poor people are tired of getting trickled upon, forgive the crude illusion. But the idea is that it allows for a massive defunding of public institutions. And you see that on a widespread basis, that people want to defund everything, public education. There's a move to defund the post office, to defund just anything, because private enterprise thinks that they can do it better and more efficiently. But the problem is that when you defund, you necessarily get worse results. You get worse results, and then that ends up becoming a rationale as to why it shouldn't exist in the first place. And so it's all part of the same thing. And then when you throw on top of it that these teachers, without real evidence, you say, these teachers are indoctrinating our youth, then it adds another layer of justification for defunding, which then gives rise to voucher systems, for-profit charters. And the ironic part is that charter schools have not systematically been shown to actually improve student achievement. There are individual ones that have been shown, but on the aggregate, they don't. What it does, though, is it actually resegregates our schools along the lines of race. And yet we're the ones promoting Mexican American studies who were accused of doing said segregation. We couldn't do it on the level that they're doing by any stretch of the imagination. And you want to see a horrible example of that? Look at the way that New Orleans public schools were, for all intents and purposes, privatized in post-Katrina. And it's a sad, sad state of affairs, because if you're a really well-performing student, which largely correlates to being white and affluent, that you've got great opportunities. But for the rest of us, you know, the public in public education, no, you're done for. And then looping back to the indoctrination issue, which I find so amusing, I struggle even as a college professor to get my students to thoroughly read the syllabus and read everything that they have that's on that syllabus, like to read, do all the readings that I have assigned.
Yeah.
And yet somehow I am such a masterful pedagogue that I can indoctrinate them into a way of thinking. It's like, it's a weird backhanded compliment. You're saying I'm such the most excellent teacher in the world, and all these folks who are doing this work are the greatest teachers in the world. When anyone who's spent any time with kids knows, just trying to get this minimal level of engagement is extraordinarily difficult. And I'm not trying to demonize kids in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that teaching is extraordinarily hard. And to sit there and say they're indoctrinating, it's ridiculous.
Well, it points out to what you mentioned earlier, which is the disconnect between lawmakers and the classroom with regards to what we've been discussing here. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson. His latest book is entitled Ban, The Fight for Mexican-American Studies in the Streets and in the Court, co-written with Robert Chang from the University of California, Irvine. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Zamba la cosa, que viva la astronomía. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva la astronomía. Me gustan los estudiantes que rugen como los vientos cuando le meten al oído sotanas y regimientos. Pajarillos libertarios igual que los elementos. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva lo experimento. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva lo experimento. Me gustan los estudiantes porque levantan el pecho cuando le dicen harina sabiéndose que es afrecho. Y no se hacen sordomudos cuando se presenta el hecho. Caramba y zamba la cosa, el código del derecho. Caramba y zamba la cosa, el código del derecho. Saldrá del horno con toda su sabrosura para la boca del pobre que come con amargura. Caramba y zamba la cosa, viva la literatura. Caramba y zamba la cosa, viva la literatura. Que vivan los estudiantes, jardín de nuestra alegría. Son aves que no se asustan de animal ni policía.
That was Los Warawao, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the history of banning ethnic studies in Arizona with Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona and the author of Ban, The Fight for Mexican-American Studies in the Streets and in the Courts. So let's go to the second part of your book here, which is the court, the legal battle here. And I want to ask you about something that you alluded to in your book, and just to get the timeline correct, because you sort of alluded to a possible fix before the legal battle started. So was it before or during, to clear up the ambiguity here?
Yeah. So this is where it gets really complicated. And it's funny because before my co-author and I wrote the book, the first thing we had to do was create this timeline that I think is like 4 pages long, because it's ridiculously complicated. So there were actually 2 different trials. There was the federal one, federal two, Ninth Circuit. So there were actually 4 different trials that occurred. Okay. The 3 in federal court were all interrelated, but there was an administrative law judge hearing that was very suspect. And so historically what happened was that Tucson Unified was going to cave to the pressure, and they had the votes on the board to eliminate the program. And now, granted, the person who introduced the resolution, Mark Stegman, said he wasn't trying to eliminate the program. He said he was just going to demote it from, say, English from a Mexican-American's perspective to counting as a core graduation requirement to being an elective. Well, if you talk to any student, you're not going to take two English classes. They didn't want to take one. So, I mean, by default, he's a smart enough guy to know that that would lead to the elimination of the program. So that's when they were going to ram it through, eliminate the program and be done with it. That's when you saw massive student protests around April 26th and then and May 3rd around the school board meetings. And after all of that pressure came in, that's when the district decided to take the appeals route that's embedded in HB 2281. And the appeal was not along, like, they didn't appeal it to like a federal court. They have made an appeal to an administrative law judge. And part of the reason why my colleague and I asked this question, like, was the fix in, was that no matter what happened from this hearing, John Hoopenthal did not actually have to abide by it. So we could have completely won that. And he didn't. And it's like, well, if he doesn't have to abide by it, why in the world would you go through these days and days and days of testimony and earlier providing depositions and all these different things? And then the trial itself was just ridiculous because you literally had, I mean, this is where I don't have to be a creative person to write that. Like, I just have to be able to say, this is what I saw happen in front of me. The state brought in an quote unquote expert witness named Sandra Stotsky. Now, she's an endowed chair at the University of Arkansas. And this is a weird area because they have an entire department where everyone is an endowed chair. And that's for people who aren't in academia, that's really rare. Like, you're lucky to have one endowed chair in prestigious departments, let alone like, I think, 9 or 10. Well, what happened is the Walton family from Walmart bought the whole area and then brought in educational experts that would reify their own ideas about school choice, I mean, all the privatization of schools. So Walmart. They were literally, yeah. So this is the, basically for all intents and purposes, she was the Walmart chair of ed policy. So she comes in and you had her saying, I do not know about barrio pedagogy, which is a core of the Mexican American studies program, a core theoretical idea. I don't know about critical race theory. I don't know about critical pedagogy and theorists like Paulo Freire. At right as you would turn, she would say, but looking at this curriculum, it doesn't promote critical thinking skills. So she literally says, I'm not an expert in this area. And yet she said, but it's not effective. It's not an effective approach. You then had, yeah, exactly. You then had Jeff Milam from the University of Arizona College of Ed saying that, you know, talking about the educational benefits of diverse perspectives in education, his work as part of a larger collective, like he was part of the larger collective that helped create the diversity rationale. So the empirical justification for affirmative action showing that diversity actually increases education for all students. And he's taught critical race theory at the University of Arizona. And at the end of the day, Judge Koval said, I find Dr. Stotsky's testimony particularly compelling and Dr. Milam's of minimal value. And we're like, why are we wasting our time?
People
here?
Can't see me, but I'm just stunned in disbelief, over what you just said, but please continue.
So that's why we said, why, you know, was the fix in? Because really it was up to the Tucson Unified School District's lawyers, you know, to kind of give them the lay of the land and say, hey, these are our options and this is what can possibly come out of it. And in particular, that John Hoopenthal wouldn't have to abide by any ruling. That should be the number one thing right there that you say, don't go that route. Don't do it. Because we already saw that even if the statistical evidence and his audit evidence shows one thing, he's going to go in the opposite direction. So why waste everybody's time? Is it just a performance to try to tamp down the pushback that they were getting? Who knows? You know, but the bottom line is that it was kind of the definition of a kangaroo court, that you're just like, you're like, this cannot be happening here. It feels like, you know, an old school, like if you're watching with Audacity, like, I don't know, To Kill a Mockingbird or something. Oh, that's probably that's too loaded of a one. But bottom line is, like, what constitutes evidence? What doesn't? Why would you pursue this route? It was just like, why. So now that was separate from the different judgments that went from the federal court with Judge Tashima up to the Ninth Circuit and then back to Judge Tashima. And that's where we actually ended up winning in federal court, where they found that the law was unconstitutional.
My goodness. And I got to use the word again, absurdity, with regards to this particular court case. But what was not absurd was the solidarity that people receive with regards to Mexican-American studies, particularly the plaintiffs, because among the other organizations that supported this case, or the plaintiffs, I should say, included ethnic studies organizations with regards to African-Americans, Asian-Americans, library organizations. There was, I think you mentioned in your book, something of a comic book association as well. I didn't know there was one, but I'm like, okay, you guys can join the party as well. So, but in all seriousness, tell us about this component of the case and how it lends itself to something that I sort of alluded earlier, which is that because of the ambiguity of this law, other ethnic studies organizations or academics recognize the danger if this were to go elsewhere in other parts of the country and in other parts of academia.
Absolutely. So that many people and many organizations understood what was riding on this case, because there's an organization called ALEC, which is, oh God, the American, I forget the like legislative, basically what they do is it's a conservative organization that if they find a piece of legislation that passes in a specific state, then they take it and run with it in other states where they think it could pass. And it becomes sort of like a Mad Lib. So like when there was the movement to ban bilingual education throughout the country, it started in California, and that almost verbatim verbiage goes to, say, you know, Arizona. And they'll say, you know, because we believe this in the state of California, take out California, put in Arizona. So folks knew that, like, they're really clear about the domino effect that something like this can have, and it can go really, really, really fast. And so this is sort of like, this is our last stand. If we can't get this anywhere where there's ethnic studies, it can be under attack. And even broader than that, it's not just an ethnic studies issue, because it's, you know, it's that whole thing of like, if we're saying that a banning is okay under certain circumstances, it opens up just whatever the person in charge, whatever their political beliefs are. And the weird part is that the folks who keep pushing for these bannings, like a Tom Hornet and John Hoopenthal, they don't think about the inverse of if somebody else was in charge. So if we're talking about, say, like foul, murderous, genocidal, you know, rape culture in a book, the first book that would be banned is the Bible.
Yes.
But that's not on the table, because, oh, well, that's a holy text. And, you know, and so there's no real principle guiding it. It's more of just what I think I don't like. And that's a really dangerous precedent to set, because it should be above your, just your own personal preferences, your likes and dislikes. I dislike that, therefore it should never be taught in any of these schools. And so that's why so many librarians, the National Association of Chicano Studies, the American Educational Research Association, all of these organizations saw that the free flow of ideas is integral to education, broadly defined. But if you start putting a roadblocks in that, all of a sudden it makes it very difficult to have the discussions, dialogues that are necessary for democracy to survive, because then you only get one viewpoint. And ironically, the people who are propagating this idea that we need to have a banning paint themselves as these victims of multiculturalism. I mean, that's the whole idea behind, say, a quote unquote Fox News. You know, we're fair and balanced because of the liberal media out there marginalizes our voices. And it's like, that's not actually empirically true. And at the same time, what you're really doing is you paint yourself, there's a certain ironic twist of fate here, where these folks paint themselves as a victim of the culture wars. You know, it's just, it's so hard to be a straight white man nowadays. It's so hard to be a cis man. You know, it's so hard to be this. It's so hard to be that, which then gives justification to lash out, to say against people who are actually being systemically marginalized by the system. And so that's where we're at right now, is that unfortunately we're catering to this imagined victimhood when in fact we really need to be talking about the systemic realities that harm low-income brown communities. And we're so taking our eyes so far off the prize on that because of these systemic distractions. But unfortunately, you know, while we won in the Mexican American Studies case, in some respects, we're kind of losing right now in the larger cultural sphere.
Yes. And that's something I alluded to earlier in the show and something that we'll wrap up with, which is how relevant this book is with the larger struggle that we see nationwide now, not only limited to education, but even in the workplace now as well, with regards to this anti-DEI movement, however one wants to describe it. But I want to reiterate something that we alluded to as well, that while the conversation here is about Mexican-American studies, it's about ethnic studies as a whole and underlying the two issues that are motivating this reactionary movement. One is censorship and the defunding of public education as well, which is why this book is so important and so relevant at this time. So I teased it at the beginning of the show, but I think it makes sense that we ended here in the last few minutes that we have is the relevance of this book with regards to recent events or any events. It's sweeping. I'll admit that it's sort of a vague, ambiguous question to ask, but it's vague and ambiguous for the simple fact that we don't know how far this anti-diversity movement is going, because clearly we've been talking about academia and the classroom, but it's gone beyond that. So what can we draw from this book with regards to recent events? Can we draw any inspiration, any direction, any sort of understanding of what are the next steps that lie ahead?
Absolutely. So first things first, the direct parallel between what happened in Tucson and the DEI efforts right now, it's the same playbook. You take this idea that's not well understood, just DEI, and then you just, when you have someone like a Chris Rufo just going after it, going, you know, constantly saying, this is evil. It hurts white people in this way. It hurts men in this way. It just basically, it's that whole idea of a solution in search of a problem instead of a problem in search of a solution.
You just mentioned Chris Rufo, and that reminds me that we're going to do a similar show on this, on ethnic studies in Texas, because he's done quite a few shenanigans in Texas lately, but continue.
He has. He absolutely has. And so if you want to hear the underlying irony of this, because, you know, I'm going to ironically throw something, twist something on its head, that pulling off of Ben Shapiro, and it hurts me just to say this, facts don't care about your feelings. And the fact of the matter is that this whole idea of DEI being like this radical over taking over of everything is such a misnomer. And part of the reason why I say that is I run in radical spheres, and not a single leftist, not liberal, but a single leftist who I know actually really likes DEI stuff. They actually think that it can, you know, make people feel good about multiculturalism without doing a lot of structural change. I don't always agree with that analysis, but the point being that if you actually talked to true radicals, they're not doing DEI work. It's a very middle of the ground. It's the same way that affirmative action was a compromise between left and right. It was a very middle of the ground approach. But when you keep attacking it from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, it becomes seen as this leftist radical approach when it's anything but that. And it drives me nuts in the larger political discourse right now, because you see so many liberal centrists who are just running away from DEI, running away from woke. I mean, for crying out loud, woke was, not to be too simplistic, but it was created by Black folk to say, stay aware of racism so you can survive.
Yes.
You know, what's wrong with that? You know, but again, the terms get twisted by opportunistic folk. And again, you know, just because you think woke means something, just because you think DEI means something, because you're feeling it, it doesn't make it true. And this is one of the reasons why it's so important to have these discussions. And I love the way that, going back to that kangaroo court that I was talking about, my dear friend and colleague, Jeff Milam, because these ideas, ethnic studies, DEI, you know, wokeness, whatever they are, they're always seen as so divisive. It's always they're divisive. And they asked him about that when he was on the stand. He said, isn't teaching about the oppression of Mexican Americans historically, you know, leading to these social divisions? And he said, no, I think that not teaching an honest history is what leads to the social divisions that we have right now. And that for me was a massive change, because right now you have so many centrist liberals just running scared from this stuff. I mean, the day after the election, Joe Scarborough was a conservative, but he was on MSNBC, which is a largely liberal network, was proclaiming, this is the death of woke. And you see the same thing from like a center left comedian like Bill Maher. Like every time, like he dedicates so much time. This is the death of woke. You know, if Kamala Harris's campaign just hadn't been so woke. And I'm like, she freaking paraded around with Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney more than she had like a Palestinian or an undocumented person or a trans person. Like, where is the woke in the campaign? So you have sort of these scared liberals who are saying, oh no, this is the death of wokeness, this is the death of DEI and all this stuff. And all that they're doing is they're continuing to capitulate to these right-wing whims. And they're really just out there saying, okay, just please don't come after us anymore. And unfortunately, that strategy doesn't work. Because if you actually pay attention to right-wing media, I mean, and this goes back to like Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, you know, the 90s, 2000s, et cetera. They are literally calling for a death of liberalism. They call liberalism, not even leftism, but just liberalism, a social disease. There's no negotiating with that. And you see that in the MAGA crew right now, where folks would rather have, like, they'd rather vote for Vladimir Putin than Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. Again, facts don't care about your feelings. These areas matter. And unfortunately, while I can't really rely on the right except to be the right and do this opportunistic race baiting, creating a brown scare or a red scare or, you know, a Black Lives Matter scare or a trans scare, what I can't tolerate is the liberals continuing to capitulate to this, because their capitulation leads to the harm in our communities. Because when we stand as a united force, that's when we can actually fight and win.
Thank you.
But unfortunately, our community isn't going anywhere, but we're the ones who are targeted by it. I mean, for crying out loud, the raids are already going on. There's a whole string of folks who I've been in contact with of Native Americans up in Phoenix who are getting detained because ICE can't tell the difference between Latinos and Native folks, not saying that one deserves to be targeted and not, but the point being that folks are already getting raided. Folks are already being targeted. This is the time to fight, and we can't afford to sit here and be, well, DEI makes me uncomfortable. I don't care. These are manufactured crises. It's a manufactured crisis that's happened every year. And the more that you keep capitulating, the farther to the right that it goes. And the problem is right now, that the current president does not believe in democracy. He believes in being a totalitarian. You can't sit this one out. This is the time we have to fight.
Yes, because what is education but the pursuit of knowledge? This umbrella that we describe as ethnic studies also includes Latin American history, African history, Southeast Asian history, and everything in between. And to not take the time to study and instead ban those studies without understanding how U.S. history has imposed a variety of things on those parts of the world leads us to the scary times that we see now. We saw this in Arizona almost 20 years ago. We see this now nationwide, unfortunately. And so we hope we do our best, to the best of our abilities, on a program like this to have enlightened guests like Nolan Cabrera on the show. So once again, we've been speaking with Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona. His recent book is entitled Ban, The Fight for Mexican-American Studies in the Streets and in the Courts, co-written with Robert Chang from the University of California, Irvine. Nolan Cabrera, it's been fun. It's been insightful. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, January 31st. Here are some headlines. Divers returned to the icy Potomac River today to scour for aircraft components to support the National Transportation Safety Board's investigation into the cause of a mid-air collision Wednesday night. 67 people died when an American Airlines regional jet collided with a U.S. Black Hawk helicopter, and both aircraft crashed into the Potomac River. Investigators have recovered the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder from the passenger plane involved in the crash. Officials are still searching for one recorder from the Black Hawk helicopter. The National Transportation Safety Board aims to release a preliminary report within 30 days. However, according to NTSB board member Todd Inman, it will likely take a year, if not more, to determine the true cause of the crash. Meanwhile, the incident has raised concerns about a shortage of air traffic controllers and how it impacts aviation safety, according to an air traffic safety report distributed to the Washington Post. Staffing levels were not normal inside Reagan National Airport's control tower at the time of the collision, with no single controller dedicated to managing helicopter traffic. In related news, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries today denounced President Trump for saying to reporters yesterday that federal efforts to promote diversity are to blame for the deadly crash. Jeffries said during a press conference in his district in Brooklyn, quote, "It's a very irresponsible statement that was made by the president," close quote. Jeffries also said the president's comments were shameful, especially since the recovery efforts are still underway and the true cause of the crash remains unknown. In other news, the director of communications for the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, also known as UNRWA, told reporters today in Geneva that her agency continues to deliver aid, but that any disruptions to its work in Gaza would put a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas at risk. New Israeli legislation bans the agency, UNRWA, from any activities in Israel, effectively cutting off its ability to deliver aid to Gaza. In related news, a small U.S. security firm is hiring nearly 100 U.S. Special Forces veterans to help run a checkpoint in Gaza during the Israeli-Hamas ceasefire, according to a company spokesperson and a recruitment email seen by Reuters. The move introduces armed American contractors into the heart of one of the world's most violent conflict zones. The deployment of armed U.S. contractors in Gaza after 14 months of war is unprecedented. It raises concerns about accountability and poses the risk that Americans could be drawn into the fighting. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.